military figures. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Cleaning up the mess left behind by Storm Eunice that battered the UK this week. With record speeds of nearly 200 kilometers per hour, much of the country from Scotland to England felt the force of the storm's temper. Footage posted to social media showed trees fall, history be realigned, railway travel disrupted, planes struggling to land, iconic landmarks damaged. The capital, London, issued its first ever rat severe weather warning. Here, too, authorities asked residents not to leave home.
So the message to Londoners is, whilst the Met Office has the red weather warning, stay indoors. Storm Eunice is the worst storm we've faced in 3 decades. It's really important we don't inadvertently put ourselves in harm's way by being outdoors.
Many heeded the warning and stayed home. Others did not. 3 people were killed.
One of those killed, a woman in her 30s traveling in a car with a man of the same age here in North London when this tree fell onto their vehicle, killing her but sparing her partner.
Eunice knocked out electricity for tens of thousands of households on its path. The government had already been warned that the UK lacks the resilience to deal with storms, particularly in terms of electricity infrastructure. Here in London, there is a sense of worry about what's to come next.
I guess you're just not really used to it happening, and I guess it's just one of those things that's going to happen more often, and we need to do more to be prepared to deal with them.
I'd say it's quite concerning because it kind of makes me think of the bigger picture of where the entire climate is headed, where we're headed as a species.
Everything was just in disarray. It was crazy and chaotic, and yeah, I know a lot of people felt scared.
Eunice was predicted to be the first storm in 30 years and certainly won't be the last. The clear-up phase is well underway now, but the wider debate about the state of the UK's resilience against storms is only just gathering pace. Saeed Pourreza, London.
On Friday, school pupils held protests in over 40 cities across Italy demanding the government to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school. The demonstrations were staged after a student, 16-year-old Giuseppe Lenoci, died in a road accident on Monday while he was on board a truck for a school work internship. Last month, another student, 18-year-old Lorenzo Perrelli, was crushed to death by a steel girder of 150 kilos while working in an internship for a private company.
È una vergogna.
They should be ashamed. School principals should be reported to the authorities for striking deals with private companies without being provided assurances on working conditions in factories. They have been reckless and should be punished.
Lavoro non pagato, praticamente sfruttamento.
School work internship is equivalent to unpaid work. It is just another form of exploitation. In most cases, it doesn't give anything to students. It only helps companies make more profit.
About 3,000 students gathered in central Rome demanding the government to remove the education minister and scrap obligatory work experience programs for high school students introduced by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi in 2015. In Turin, tension and anger went out of control when a group of students tried to break into the local headquarters of industrial employers group Confindustria and were repelled by police with some batons being wielded, with at least 7 officers being hurt.
We are staging protests also to raise awareness over our living conditions as young adults. Our generation is suffering greatly also from the anti-COVID measures, which restricts our freedom to move, to interact socially. We are left alone with our phones following school lessons online, with our psychological scars, and the government is not doing anything to help us.
School dropout levels in Italy are among the highest in the EU, and due to the pandemic, with the government quickly deciding to make all learning remote. Also, the cases of social withdrawal and self-harm among young people are on the rise. Healthcare professionals are warning. In the past 2 years, and especially in recent months, Italy has been the scene of protests across the country. Rallies have been held against deteriorating living conditions, mandatory vaccination and health passes, as well as what the protesters describe as the government's mismanagement of the COVID pandemic. Max Civili, Rome.
Dozens of Nigerian Muslims, mostly supporters of prominent cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, demonstrated in Abuja to condemn Saudi Arabia for the war on Yemen and its continued blockade of the impoverished country. They said the bombing of civilian targets by the Saudi-led coalition and its siege on Yemen has caused a serious humanitarian situation there.
A coalition of Saudi Kingdom and that of United Arab Emirates, we are launching a strike on the innocent people of Yemen. They have been killing a lot of women, children, men, and everywhere, at their houses, at their business places, hospitals, schools, everywhere. Nowhere is safe in Yemen. They are killing, and the world is silent.
The Saudi war has escalated recently as Riyadh has intensified its aerial and ground attacks, worsening the humanitarian situation in Yemen. The protesters said the ultimate goal of Saudi Arabia is to reinstate the former Yemeni president.
They want to return Mr. Hadi back to power. You can't return somebody back to power with killing those people you want him to come and rule. You are killing them and you want him back to come and do what? What is he coming back to do? To come and rule who? Innocent people or dead bodies?
The protesters said human feeling should prevail over the intrigues of the power struggle on the situation in Yemen. They added that the senseless shelling of innocent civilians in Yemen must stop, while the international community has a moral responsibility to put a stop to the carnage. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
A new report, an assessment of the British government's widely criticized multi-million-dollar-a-year counter-extremism strategy known as PREVENT, first introduced after the 2005 London bombings.
The People's Review of PREVENT essentially puts forward the voices of those who have been impacted by PREVENT, as opposed to the government review, which is speaking primarily to people who are in receipt of PREVENT funding and essentially have a vested interest in having more PREVENT.
Millions of those funds are being injected into areas with 73% Muslim populations, codenamed PPAs, Prevent Priority Areas. The British government dismisses all criticism of its strategy and claims Prevent is a vital part of their counterterrorism work, which safeguards vulnerable people from being drawn into terrorism since 2012. The authors of the 65-page People's Review of Prevent think otherwise.
It hasn't been vital, and I think many people, not just community groups, not just human rights groups, but even members of parliament and UN special rapporteurs have put together criticisms and concerns about the fact that this could potentially be causing radicalization rather than stopping it.
Bearing the brunt of it all, Britain's Muslim community, children interrogated by PREVENT officers, at times without their parents knowing.
Over 50% of the referrals within PREVENT are of young people and children. That includes children as young as 4 and children at primary school. There's no possibility that they're at risk of being drawn into terrorist activities.
The review cites multiple examples of the devastation caused by PREVENT. The so-called Trojan horse affair is one. False reports in 2014 of an Islamist plot to take over schools in Birmingham, ending up ruining the lives and careers of dozens of school teachers.
The problem with the school was that it was a Muslim-led school, that it was a Muslim-majority school, and what was being built up, if that school had continued its successes, would be a group of Muslim-led schools within a Muslim-led academy trust. That was what was being broken up.
Despite its failures, though, there are now fears that the government here might be marketing PREVENT to other countries, some with questionable human rights records. The authors of People's Review of PREVENT and other critics say this strategy is racist, fuels and legitimizes Islamophobia, and therefore must be scrapped once and for all. Saeed Bourizza, London.
A dream has become a reality. The Conference of the Birds, composed by the brilliant young musician Maysam Marvasti and inspired by a poem of the same name written by poet Attar of Nishapur in the 12th century, performed here in London. It's a story all Iranians are familiar with, about an epic journey to find the Simorgh.
The Simorgh is to the east what the phoenix is to the west, a mythical creature that symbolizes transformation. And the story of the Simorgh is a spiritual one, full of courage, determination, and self-discovery.
I think it's the first time I've seen so prominently advertised a non-Western musical traditional concert. And I've got a long-standing interest in music from the different parts of the Islamic world. It kind of evokes sort of deeper feelings, spiritual feelings. And the fact that this specific concert is about kind of a spiritual poem, it taps into something which I think a lot of us are looking for, especially in this post-pandemic, current pandemic situation. We're looking for some deeper meanings. So I think it will be striking a chord for a lot of people.
It's a mix of fusion of different music, and that's always interesting. And it's Eurasian music, and it uses different instruments from across Asia to represent birds, and it just sounded lovely.
Even though there are differences, cultural differences between these places and these peoples, and those differences should be recognised in general, that through things like music and art, there can also be synergy and, things can work together as well.
5 years in the making, the Conference of the Birds, conducted by Farnoush Behzad, brought together musicians and instruments from across the world. It fuses Azeri, Chinese, Indian, Arabic, Afghan, Armenian and Persian music, brought to the audience by a Western orchestra. The performance was accompanied by two elocutionists who narrated the story and animated clips of birds and their migratory lives. The art and culture of Iran needs no introduction, renowned worldwide. But young Iranian artists living far from home are always looking for ways to capture the spirit of their homeland and offer Western audiences a taste of Iran. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fuelled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been considered deeply Islamophobic.
Press TV spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay. The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined, and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified, seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy, because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology, and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
The United Nations Aid Chief Martin Griffiths said the humanitarian operations in Yemen is about to start doing a lot less. In his latest briefing to the UN Security Council, he warned that the aid agencies are quickly running out of money, forcing them to slash life-saving programs. His remarks has sparked harsh reactions in Yemen.
The UN's decision to cut humanitarian aid threatens the lives of millions of Yemenis. The United Nations is subject to the conditions of donors, most of whom are from the countries of the Saudi-led coalition, and therefore they are politicizing humanitarian aid to achieve what they have failed militarily. The United Nations describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and Yemenis have been suffering since the beginning of the war, and the UN aid is already scarce.
Since January, the World Food Programme has reduced rations for 8 million of the 13 million Yemenis it feeds each month. Griffiths said rations may be cut further from March or even stopped, meaning that millions of Yemenis may die of hunger.
When we see the reality and what is happening on the ground and how the Yemeni army continues to achieve victories in various battlefronts, we realize that the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its declared goals, and therefore they are seeking to put pressure on the Yemeni army by reducing humanitarian aid to the country. Reports confirm the high rate of death among children, and this confirms the failure of the United Nations humanitarian operation in Yemen.
The reduction in food rations comes with millions of people in Yemen facing starvation as a result of the ongoing years-long Saudi war and the blockade imposed on their country. As observers say, the United Nations may announce a death sentence for millions of Yemenis if gaps in its funding are not filled. They warn that if the world body wants to save more lives in Yemen, it must reduce the operational expenses of its agencies that deplete the humanitarian funding. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi is in Qatar's capital Doha in his first visit to a Persian Gulf Arab country. The 13th Iranian administration is keeping true to Raisi's campaign promise of enhancing ties with its regional neighbors. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why that is important for this administration. While there, Iran's President also spoke on the Vienna JCPOA revival talks, which will be another issue that we will cover with our guests. Well, let's talk with a journalist and political analyst. First, University Professor and Political Analyst Fouad Azadi will be joining us later. And Journalist and Political Analyst Elijah Magnier joins us from Brussels.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, Elijah, I'm going to start with you. We're going to have Fouad Azadi join us a little later. Looking at the Iranian president's visit to Qatar, I mean, this is an important trip in itself, but it's the choice that he has made, the first Persian Gulf Arab country for him to visit. Why did he pick Qatar, and what was the reason behind it, that you think?
Thank you for having me. I think Qatar is very important because when Qatar was under the Saudi Arabia sanctions a few years ago, Iran was the first to give it a hand, support all the flights in and out, supply Qatar with everything that it needed, particularly when the Gulf country followed the Saudi embargo on Qatar. That's one. Second, Qatar is a very important country. It's playing a role between the West and the Middle East and the East. It has a very good relationship with Iran, and it has good relationship with the Gulf country and the Western country. So Qatar has an important role to play. However, we should not undermine the Iranian message, on the other hand, that Iran is, and said already when President Raisi took power, that is going to turn his back toward to the West and turn his face toward its neighbors in the first place and the East in the second place, which Iran takes us to this decision to establish excellent relationship with neighboring country. Saudi Arabia is still struggling to have an independent decision and walk toward Iran as Iran is doing so. And that will put the security of the Middle East and West Asia in the hand of the country of the Middle East. And Iran is offering a lot of new projects, particularly the Shahabar Harbor that is relating Eurasia with Turkey, Azerbaijan, Europe, Africa, and India, and has a lot to offer. So a good cooperation between Qatar and Iran can support the Middle East and the area and can really give an incentive to other countries to take a step away from the U.S. hegemony.
Well, when we take a look at this 13th administration headed by Ebrahim Raisi, true to his campaign promise, and as we have seen him putting it into action, he has made one of his number one priorities to be, if not the number one priority, to enhance enhance relations with regional countries. And he has made that part of his foreign policy plank. Why was that so important for Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, which we can see now with this visit that, you know, he's living up to his promise?
Yes, I think President Raisi has decided to adopt a complete different policy in his new government and in the 4 years of his ruling. The relationship with the West prove that it is irrelevant and it is not useful. It brought a lot of problems to Iran, and particularly when the West was not up to its promises, violated the JCPOA, and Europeans could not do anything to honor that signature. Therefore, it was important for Iran to say, okay, I'm going to look after my own economy, and I'm going to continue, but I will not depend on the West. I will not expect anything, and consider that the sanction will remain and look after the interests of my country without waiting for the lifting of the sanctions. So there is a lot of potentiality in the Middle East and in Eurasia, in China and in Russia. And this is why President Raisi established very important and significant deal with Russia and China, and now is turning toward the Middle Eastern country, particularly the Gulf country, to say, let us work together, and we can do it without depending on the West. So we see that President Raisi has established a plan, a roadmap for his government, and it is fulfilling it slowly but surely.
Okay, we have Fouad Izzadi with us now. Fouad Izzadi, I'd like to quote you what Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said while he was in Doha. He said, after several decades of aggressive and occupying presence of the arrogant powers, regional countries are now taking control of the region in their hands. Is this related to the fact that Iran's president has made establishing closer ties with the regional countries and enhancing those ties a basis for him to come out and say this?
You know, when he was running for presidency, this was one of the topics that he covered a lot, working more with Iran's neighbors, looking towards Asia, and not waiting for some agreement in some European capital. And that's what he has implemented. You know, Iran helped Qatar a lot when the Saudis and Saudi friends in this part of the world blockaded that country. The only route that was open was the northern route towards Iran. And Iran did this because Iran realized that if the Saudi government or UAE be able to bully others in this part of the world, then you'll face more difficulty as the time passes. And Qatar has realized the value of having close relations with Iran, and Iran does the same thing. And not only Iran and Qatar are neighbors, they share an important oil and gas field, and they can help each other a lot. And that's in line, very much in line with Mr. Raisi's, President Raisi's foreign policy goals.
Well, we're going to get back to some of those issues, regional issues, security-wise, but I'd like to get to the statements he made, Elijah Magnier, on the revival talks that are happening in Vienna for the JCPOA, in which he says, Ibrahim Raisi said, the deal requires the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions, the protection of Iranian nation's interests, valid guarantees, and the closure of political cases. These requirements don't sound like there's anything new to it, but perhaps at this stage it's a reflection of Iran reiterating its stance, because as Iran sees it, the ball is in the court of not just the Europeans, but really the U.S. in particular. What's your reading into it?
I think Iran made it very clear that the JCPOA signed in 2015, either it is fully implemented or Iran needs to protect itself. And by protecting itself, because it doesn't want to go through another experience at 2018, when President Donald Trump revoked the deal unilaterally and imposed on his European partner not to deal with Iran. Therefore, Iran is saying, okay, well, I need a guarantee now that you're not going to do it again, but not only that you're going to respect the deal that you're going to sign and allow all the Western and all the other non-Western companies to deal with Iran and with the Iranian Central Bank and vice versa. Now, if this is not going to happen, Iran is going to take a step back and say, well, I'm going to keep some of my, there are points in the deals that Iran is working on right at the moment in Vienna to say, I need a backup and a plan B. And this plan B, until you prove, United States and Europe, that you're going to accept the deal, abide by it, respect it, and I want to see it implemented, and you return all the asset and the money that is frozen in different banks around the world, I am going to keep my advanced technology. I will not go to further than 60% enrichment uranium, but I'm not going to destroy my nuclear sites as Iran did with Iraq in 2015, 2016. So this is what Iran is negotiating. But what is important here is that Iran is negotiating from a position of power. And the reason why Iran is negotiating from a position of power, rejecting the presence of a U.S. flag in the room, a U.S. negotiator, refusing to talk to the U.S. Envoy, is because Iran is saying, if you don't do it in a way that I feel comfortable and the Iranian population are happy with the outcome, I don't care about the deal. You can keep your sanctions as they are, because they prove invalid and useless, because Iran did not submit to the Americans since 1979, and the sanctions are present and they are increasing and have reached their maximum. So the U.S. can no longer impose right. further sanctions on Iran.
Okay, Fouad Izadi, I'm guessing that it's a balancing act, not for Iran, but some of the countries that Iran is establishing close ties with or closer ties with, when some of those countries have ties with the U.S., and they're rather strong ones. I mean, we know that Qatar is one of them. We know that Saudi Arabia, which Iran is in talks with, and perhaps some other countries. Does the fact that Iran, to make forays economically into those countries, mean that there will be a balance then when it comes to the relationship?
You know, Iran believes in countries being able to make their own foreign policy decisions. And Iran respects the independence of other countries. So Qataris or other countries in this part of the world can have good relations with United States, Russia, China, whatever their leaders decide to do is not going to be something that Iran is going to be concerned about. What is missing in the past among some of these countries is that they put all their eggs in one basket. They become client states of the United States. And that is going to hurt them, as we see. And I think some of these countries are realizing that fact, that just following U.S. dictates is not a good foreign policy choice. And what Iran hopes is that these countries actually become more independent in their foreign policy decision-making. And if that happens, obviously, given the fact that Iran is a major country in this part of the world, both in terms of population, technology, other advances that Iran has made in the last 40 years, then Iran would be an attractive partner and neighbor to work with. And at the same time, these countries are welcome to have relations with others. And so what the problem has been is United States wanting to have a monopoly when it comes to countries in this part of the world, that they have to have good relations with the U.S. and then cut relations with countries like Iran or Russia and China. And that is what Iran is against. That is why Iran-U.S. relations are in difficulty, because Iran does not take dictates from Western countries, from the United States. And Iran hopes the same thing happens in this part of the world.
Well, I'd like to expand on this issue with you, if I may, Elijah Magnier, because as our guest, Therefore, Azadi mentioned, some of these countries, and I think one of the ones at the top of the list would be Saudi Arabia, has realized, as our guest there said, you can't lay all your eggs in one basket. I mean, at this point, the U.S. President Joe Biden, I don't believe, even communicates with the Saudi crown prince, because I don't believe, based on what has been out there, reports that he believes that he is the one that is running the country, because he doesn't hold that title officially in terms of him being the ruler of Saudi Arabia. But my point being is that given that, and Saudi Arabia as an example, that maybe there's an alignment that is taking place here with these regional countries, leaving the U.S. out, and then for them to take matters into their own hands.
I don't think this is has matured yet in the Middle East, and it takes time because the Gulf countries are very fragile because their ruling depends on the support of the United States of America and their military bases spread in the region. Therefore, the cooperation between countries of the region in the Middle East and the Gulf country in Iran, yes, that can be to a certain level. But I don't think these countries, at the exception of Iran, has the guts and the courage to stand against the U.S. So we saw that the Americans took a position from Mohammed bin Salman, but they've never stopped supplying Saudi Arabia with weapons, particularly to bomb Yemen. And they're still benefiting from their presence in Saudi Arabia and their military bases there. So I don't think this is going to happen now. And I think Iran is saying, well, you look at my experience since 1979, and today I am in a position of strength, and I am negotiating with a superpower from a position of strength. This is no longer a superpower because the unilateral ruling of the world is falling down. It is a big power, and I was able to stand against it. So you can try to create a cooperation without necessarily being independent from the U.S. because you can't. And I don't think the Middle Eastern country are in a position today to work with Iran and take a step away from the U.S. because they need the U.S. protection. Donald Trump said it very clearly. Without us, you will fall in 1 week.
Right. But that could also be construed as, okay, then maybe we should do something about providing our own protection, and perhaps regional security can be established with regional countries. All right, there are two issues remaining here for this program that we have to cover. Fuad Izzati, Iran's president, talked about Yemen, that this is a humanitarian situation, an obligation. Lifting the siege has to happen for the oppressed nation, and that the Yemeni talks are the sole solution to the Yemeni crisis. If he's making those statements out of Doha and Qatar, does that send the message that perhaps Qatar could play a role in, or some kind of role in resolving the war on Yemen?
You know, generally the Saudis, whenever Iran talks about an Arab country, they become unhappy. They say that this is an internal affair, Arab affair. And Yemenis are Arabs. And for the last 6-7 years, the Saudis have been killing Arab women and children on a daily basis. So when President Raisi talks about Yemen in an Arab capital, he, I think, basically is pointing out to this fact that it's the responsibility of Arab countries to resolve this issue, given the fact that some of these countries, at least, don't like Iran to get involved in these matters. So if Iran decides not to be part of resolving that problem, then other countries, Arab countries, should engage in that. The unfortunate fact is that Iran has been one of the few countries in the world that has been able to have foreign policy that's independent from American pressure and support the oppressed people of Yemen and talk about the grave injustice that's going on there. And other countries, for one reason or another, have been generally silent about the atrocities that is taking place in Yemen. And what the Saudis have done, UAE also, is that they have actually increased Iran's influence in an Arab country by engaging in this reckless policy of trying to bomb their way and achieve a foreign policy goal by just killing innocent people in a country. And the hope is that they change course, they realize that they have made a mistake, and the sooner they do that, it's going to be better for them, because continuing the current policy is a major failure, and it's going to cause difficulties.
Well, you had Raisi talk about the issue of Palestine, Elijah Magner, and that's my final question, saying that that's the main issue of the region, and Al-Thani said that they stressed the need to stop the Israeli regime's aggression against the Palestinian people and obviously find a solution. How promising is that? Will Qatar play a role? It has, more maybe than some of his Arab partners or Arab countries, that other Arab countries. But do you think that they can play a more active role? Iran obviously does its best when it comes to the resistance of the Palestinians against the Israeli regime.
Well, there are many points here. First of all, Qatar is present already in Palestine and is supporting Gaza with, of course, the approval of the Israelis. And I think the Israelis are in a position of weakness here for several points. First of all, Yemen is picking up, and Ansarullah are registering more and more victories against the occupation of Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And that frightened the Israelis because they consider the Iranians are sitting on Bab al-Mandeb. Secondly, it is in the advantage of the Israelis to accept any initiative coming from Qatar, because today the axis of the resistance, particularly Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and other groups, are becoming much stronger, and they are imposing deterrence on the Israelis, who feel weaker. And we saw that not only in the Sword of Jerusalem, but also throughout the recent month and recent weeks, how the Palestinians, they took control in hand, and they're threatening the Israelis, who are being incapable today.
Okay, I'm sorry to have jumped in. We're just fresh out of time. That was Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. Thank you for your contribution. Fuad Azadi, a pleasure, university professor and political analyst, spoke to us from Tehran. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikova Tahbayi and the entire team. It's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today we are going to touch upon the last parts of Imam Khomeini's testament where he addresses the Iranian nation. The Imam reminds the Iranian nation about the cost they have paid and the hardships they have endured to overcome the enemies and to achieve victory. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing the Iranian nation, writes in his testament that the pains and sacrifices are the cost for reaching lofty goals. He writes, "Once more, in the end of this testament, I make bequest to the Iranian nation that, in this world, the magnitude of tolerating troubles, pains, sacrifices, and deprivations are compatible with the magnitude of the goal and its value and lofty degree. What you, the noble and Mujahid nation, have risen for, have been pursuing and sacrificing your life and property, is the loftiest, highest, and most precious goal and purpose which has been and will be presented since the advent of the world till the end. And that is the school of divinity, in the broad sense of it, and the concept of monotheism with its exalted dimensions. The school of divinity and monotheism mentioned by Imam Khomeini has its roots in the belief that Allah is the only being who deserves to be worshipped. Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, "The school of divinity in its broad sense and the concept of monotheism with its exalted dimensions is the basis of creation and its ultimate point in the vast arena of being and the degrees and ranks of the unseen and the seen. And it has been manifested in the Muhammadan school in its full sense, degrees and dimensions and all efforts of great prophets, greetings of God upon them. And the great friends of God, greetings of God upon them, have been made for that, and without that, it will not be possible to reach the absolute perfection and the infinite majesty and beauty. It is that which has made the inhabitants of the earth superior to the denizens of the ethereal heavens. And what the inhabitants of earth achieve in this journey will not be achieved by any creature in the whole creation, publicly or secretly. Imam Khomeini says that the Iranian nation is marching in the way of the divine prophets. He writes, "You, the Mujahid nation, are marching under the flag which is hoisted throughout the material and spiritual world. Know it or not, you are covering the way which is the only way of all great prophets, greetings of God upon them, and the sole way of absolute salvation. It is through this motive that all friends of God hog martyrdom and consider the Red Death sweeter than honey. And your youth in the battlefronts have drunk a sip of it and have become rejoiced. And it has been manifested in their mothers, sisters, fathers, and brothers. And we should truly say, we wish we were with you to achieve a great victory. May that soothing breeze and that zealous manifestation be sweet for them." Imam Khomeini explains that the spirit of devotion and cooperation ruling in the society is one of the manifestations of this sweet sense. He writes, "We should know that this manifestation can be clearly seen in hot farms, in breathtaking factories, in workshops, in centers of industry, invention and innovation, and among the majority of the nation in markets, streets, villages, and on all those who have overtaken these affairs to serve Islam, the Islamic Republic and progress and self-sufficiency of the country. And as long as this spirit of cooperation and devotion is there in the society, the dear country is, God willing, immune against every harm. And thank God, the seminaries and universities and dear youths of the centers of knowledge and education enjoy this divine unseen blessing." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, continues in his testament, "My bequest to all is to advance with Almighty God's remembrance towards self-recognition, self-sufficiency, and independence with all their dimensions. And undoubtedly God's hand is with you. If you be at his service and continue the spirit of cooperation for the progress and sublimity of the Islamic country, with the wakefulness, vigilance, devotion, self-sacrifice, and the spirit of resistance and resolve that I see in the dear nation in the way of truth, I hope that, through Almighty God's favor, these human concepts will be transmitted to the posterior of the nation and every generation will enhance it." Imam Khomeini ends his testament with these words, "With a calm and confident heart, happy spirit, and an inward hopeful of God's favor, I take leave from the sisters and brothers and travel to the eternal abode while I am in urgent need of your good prayers. And I plead with God, the compassionate and the merciful, to accept my apology for coming short of service. And I hope that the nation will accept my apology for shortcomings and faults. They should go forward with power and resolve, knowing that with the departure of a servant, there will be no crack in the iron dam of the nation, as there are more superior servants at the service. And Allah is the guardian of this nation and the oppressed of the world."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.